Looking to start a podcast but don't know where to begin? Look no further. The team at Dodge Media Productions has 20 years of experience as podcast listeners and observing the industry and 8 years experience in podcast production. We can help you take your podcast from idea to fruition and we'll make the process seamless and easy. We'll help you with everything from recording and editing to hitting the charts on Apple Podcasts. So what are you waiting for? Contact us today and let's get started. DodgeMediaProductions.com.
You're listening to Dodge Movie Podcast. Your hosts are Christy and Mike Dodge, the founders of Dodge Media Productions. We produce films and podcasts, so this is a podcast about films. Join them as they share their passion for filmmaking.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Dodge Movie Podcast. This is episode 160, and today we are going to talk about the film Dirty Rotten Scoundrels that came out in 1988. The director's Frank Oz. I didn't know he did anything other than Muppets.
Nah. Yeah, apparently. And he was also an actor, wasn't he, in Knives Out? So he's had a broad career.
So in 82, he did The Dark Crystal, but that was puppetry.
I mean, there was a live action kid, I think, but the rest of it was puppets.
Right. And then 84, Muppets Take Manhattan, and 86, Little Shop of Horrors. So you've got
all
Seymour.
Puppetry.
The film stars Steve Martin, Michael Caine, Glenn Headley, and Ian McDiarmid, who plays Arthur. And actually, did you make a note, or I saw that it's after that character in the movie is inspired by Hobson from Arthur.
I read that in the trivia.
The DP was Michael Ballhaus. He did After Hours, a Dustin Morrow favorite from 85.
Oh, goodness.
86, The Color of Money. 88, Last Temptation of Christ. I'm sorry, everybody. And 1990's Goodfellas. So he had quite a career, and I think he had others. I just usually pick the most well-known ones when I'm doing that.
For listeners who are newer to the podcast, our friend Dustin Morrow got to program an entire month of episodes. And he did not pick films just to irritate me, but he did derive some small amount of glee from the fact that the films he picked irritated me. One of which
it's
was After Hours.
It's a great month. You should go back and listen. I think it was last August or something. I'll put it in the show notes.
And I'm glad he shared those films with us, but none of them are really my bag.
All right. Sorry, everybody. Thor's walking around, but we're going to...
Dog reassessment. He has to find a different bed to sleep in.
We're going
to
go on. The writer was Dale Launer, who did My Cousin Vinny and Ruthless People, Stanley Shapiro, That Touch of Mink.
So Stanley Shapiro, he wrote a film that this was a loose retelling of, different name. It was the one with Brando.
That Touch of Mink,
David
Pillow
Niven.
Talk or something?
I don't remember the name. I don't think it was either of those two, but that's why he gets a credit is because they... it's a remake.
Right. And then Paul Henning, who wrote for the television show Beverly Hillbillies.
Right. No relation to Doug?
Right.
Okay, that's a deep pull.
Maybe. I don't know. I will look it up.
That's a great thing. How many people in the audience know who Doug Henning is?
I know.
Timely reference, Mike.
I so wish these episodes could be interactive somehow. I mean, they are to our friends because we get texts. We get random texts with no context.
Yeah,
friends, like in the When Harry Met Sally episode, when you guys are talking about this, we don't get that benefit.
Some super fans listen to the podcast while walking their dog and thus use Siri to send me texts with stuff. So I get no context.
And they're talking back to us in real time for them. But what for
not
us?
Not real time
is,
for us. It was a month ago.
A week or...
Yeah. What? What are you talking about? It's kind of funny. It's hilarious.
It's kind of like a puzzle. You know what? They're helping our brain health.
Yeah, brain age.
Because we have to think back. Yeah, and oftentimes cool. Mike will come in and go, okay, this super fan just sent me this text. What do you think it? And I will often know, I think, because I have the benefit of not only recording the podcast, but then editing the podcast. So I've heard it and I go, oh, I know what they're talking about.
Right.
But sometimes neither one of us know.
Right. Which is funnier that I get the text because I only hear this once when I say these things and it's a month ago and I can barely remember yesterday. So for me, it's entirely brand new. Every time. It's a puzzle.
Okay. Can you tell we're a little punchy? The synopsis for this film is two con men try to settle their rivalry by betting on who can swindle a young American heiress out of $50,000 first. And when we were watching this, I thought,
oh, wow, times have changed. Because I think those stakes are so low, the $50,000. Right. Like, if there was a movie today, like, for example, what I wonder what the amount was in the Hathaway.
So, an excellent question. I did the remake. I did the Google. $50,000 at the time of that film is like $130,000 now. So still very low.
Still seems low.
And so, yes, the Rebel Wilson and Hathaway remake, I'm curious what the dollar value was. It seems higher. Like, it would be have to be higher.
Now, I'm thinking of... Did we know? I don't think we knew at the time that we meet Glenn Headley's character, but later we find out it was prize money. Remember? Well,
except, spoiler alert, everyone, her whole character is a con too.
No, I know that. But what I'm just saying that, was it that amount because they knew she had just come into that amount?
Well, possibly that was her setup, right? And we talked, this is segueing a little bit into something we said before. Why is it that we like these two characters, even though they're con artists?
Horrible people.
And I realized at the end of the film, the reason is because they get their comeuppance.
But we don't know that at the time.
We don't. And that so that part is the credit to Kane and Martin,
yeah,
that they were able to play these scoundrels in a way that was funny enough that we saw that as part of, in essence, the setup for a joke. And mm-hmm. we weren't offended by their behavior.
Yeah, I think you're right. All right. One tagline. Nice guys finish last. Meet the winners.
Ooh, good. Very good.
That's a good tagline.
That's a great tagline.
Yeah. I wish we could credit the person.
Yeah, I know. I want to find that guy in Hollywood and shake his hand.
Yeah, and go, good tagline.
Good job, Jeremy.
All right. Here's some trivia. When Frank Oz first approached Michael Caine about the key role in the movie, he tempted him with the promise of a cozy villa in the south of France for a 3-month period to shoot. Once Caine learned that the villa was between his two good buddies, Sir Roger Moore and composer Leslie Bruska, he said, I would be happy to do the film.
Fun fact, I had heard years ago that Michael Caine, at least at a certain point in his career, chose projects based on where they were filmed, where he wanted to vacation.
Mm-hmm. Smart.
Yeah. If you have the juice, go for it.
Yeah, I bet a lot of actors do that, and no, right. No shade. Like,
right.
More power to you.
However, Kim Basinger did 8 Mile, and I'm not sure that's the place she wanted a vacation.
Sorry, Detroitian. This is the first film directed by Frank Oz that does not feature a Muppet.
All right.
And it is the third of 5 collaborations with Frank and Steve Martin, who they did Bowfinger, House Sitter, Little Shop of Horrors, and The Muppet Movie. And he appears in the film as the police officer rushing Freddie to meet Lawrence at the airport near the end of the film. That's Frank Oz.
Oh, good job.
How about your pickup line to kick us off into this podcast?
Your Highness, please allow me to make this little contribution, which I actually think works pretty well.
It's a great scene because it introduces us to Michael Caine's character,
right,
whose name is Lawrence, right? Yeah,
yes.
Lawrence. And we see how the sausage is made, how he lures the ladies in, mm-hmm, and how he uses his suave and debonair, right, and appeals to them. And so it's like we get a quick, because it does happen pretty quick, a glimpse of his tactics to know what he's, right, capable of.
You've already risked too much by speaking to me.
Right.
Right.
Oh, okay, Lawrence.
But what I loved, it is kind of a funny scene because he keeps grabs her, and then another man grabs her and pushes her up against what kind of, I guess, is like a wall, but
yeah,
there's a plant in front of it. And uh-huh. So you said, do you remember what you said while we were watching this?
No.
You said, oh, I'm so sorry. You said, apparently we pushed women into plants a lot back then.
Yeah.
Because it makes me think it's suddenly last summer. I feel, yeah, like there was a scene where, yeah, or maybe they just grabbed her and this shook her by
the dame is in the way. Let's put her in the potted plant.
We should not be laughing.
Well, it's not funny if it happens in real life, but it is kind of hilarious.
But it was just like this trope that we uncovered. Yeah,
there were lots of tall potted plants that we could shove women into when they were in the way. Out of the way, broad, and push her into the plant.
We've advanced from slapping. Now we just push them into greenery.
Yeah. The Ficus Coalition did a great job in getting us, you need plants to push women into.
Oh my God, this is what happens when you don't sleep for 2 months.
Yeah. I consider this a bonus for the listener.
Listeners, I hope you're enjoying this, everybody. So we recognize him as a grifter, and then Freddie, Steve Martin's character, gets arrested and then released. And Lawrence is the one that helps. And so Freddie recognizes Lawrence as a grifter, and he returns to France to say, teach me your ways. Teach me how to do what you do. And then training begins. So there was probably some...
There is a training montage. It's awesome.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah. And one of the things that I like in that, and this is Oz has a good sense of humor.
Muppets are hilarious. In fact, after this, I was like, I should watch Muppets Take Manhattan because I'm so in love with New York. It would be fun to see all of the iconic places of New York City in that film.
Well, as an aside, we should have Jason Segel on this podcast. So he likes Muppets too. But in the montage, it shows Freddie following Lawrence from left to right across the frame. It's set up to have this kind of down these stairs to the pool. And he's walking like a schmuck. And then there's more training montage. And then they're going back the other direction. And now he's got the suave stroll.
Debonair.
So, great show, don't tell moment to show that Freddie has now progressed. He's learned. And it's such visually, it's such a great shot. Just super well done, Mr. Oz in the camera department.
Yes, it was fun. And so the bet ensues that can they con this woman out of her $50,000. And Freddie thinks he has a great idea. He has some stolen valor going on here, as our youngest son would bring out. He pretends to be an injured veteran that needs a surgery. And so it seems like a foolproof kind of thing because he gets her sympathies and says that his life could be improved if he had this surgery. And so she gladly says, we shall do it. And then the doctor jumps in and says, don't give the money to him. Give it to me because I'm performing the surgery.
So that is such a subtle sight gag because the character played by Glenn Hebley, which at the time we think is just a dim bulb, but we find out later she's actually playing a role. But she says, shouldn't the Navy pay for your operation? And he's wearing an army uniform. And that is like in A Million Ways to Die in the West when Seth MacFarlane is talking about like how little food they have, and there's the little tin plate has brie and strawberries and just a subtle sight gag. I loved it. It was such a great joke. Shouldn't the Navy pay for your operation? Really, really good.
How do the two characters, Michael Caine's character of Lawrence and Freddie, Steve Martin's character, how do they develop and change over time, or do they?
So Freddie does. This is, I thought this was fascinating. In the opening credits, it says Michael Caine and Steve Martin are, and then they cut to the title card, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yeah, I like that.
We literally tell the viewer before it starts, these guys are con artists, right? Oh. And then you see them both grifting, and Steve Martin's character, he has the rumpled linen suit, very 80s Miami Vice colors. And then you see Michael Caine's character in the navy blue blazer and the regimental tie. So it's showing them as kind of city mouse and country mouse, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then over time, they have the training montage, but you see them both, I think, pretty much stay the same. I mean, Freddie, Steve Martin's character, learns some different skills, perhaps. But they're kind of fun frenemies, like in a Real Housewives kind of way.
Very much.
That they're kind of working together, but they're trying to screw each other over, and they both know it the whole time. And then this whole time, they're both being played by Glenn Hebley's character.
Which, when does the audience find that out? Not until
the very end.
The very end, yeah. I thought it was.
Yeah, so it's like the second to last scene.
Because some movies will tip you off. Like, don't worry, these guys are going to get their comeuppance.
Yeah.
But this one waited until the very, very end.
And so we see Michael Caine laughs about it, like, well played. And Steve Martin's character is like, no, that was our money. And so they have the second to last shot where they're sitting on the bench looking out over, the Mediterranean and talking about, and then her character shows up in a different role and it works comically.
And she's running a con, but she's inviting them to be a part of it.
And I felt like real con artists would have been quicker on the pickup. They really hold on Michael Caine not getting what's going on for quite some time, which maybe works comedically. But perhaps, like, I think he would be quicker based on what we've seen in the film.
Right.
But those two characters are unrepentant. they're still con artists at the end of the film.
Yeah.
There's not really that, but they get their kind of comeuppance in a sense. And I think that's why that's the narrative question that gets answered, right? Is will they get away with this? No, the answer is no, they don't.
But will they get away with the one, the new one at the end that's proposed?
And we presume they will, but now they're her minions. And
yeah.
I thought it was great that throughout the film, they keep referring to the jackal. It's an American. And we all assume it's Steve Martin's character, Freddy. Everyone, not just Lawrence, thinks it's Freddy, but it turns out it's Glenn Healy's character. Really, really well done.
Yeah, really. Who did I say the writer? Oh, it was the Shapiro and...
Yeah, a couple fellas get the...
Michael Caine was very excited to be in this role because it was a remake of a film with Marlon Brando,
I think. Yeah. And I think David Niven.
And he was so excited to get... Because he really enjoyed... Maybe it was Niven's character that he was... and he was a big fan.
I thought they said that like he even copied the slick back hair that David Niven had in the film.
Yeah, he was very excited to do it for that reason, as well as being able to live in the south of France for 3 months.
You don't often think of Michael Caine as being a comedic actor, at least I don't. He seems a little more serious parts, some, you know, heist films, that kind of thing. But I think he did very well in this film. And of course, Steve Martin is a comic genius. And I think in the trivia, they talk about other people that were considered for that role. I just don't know if it would work with anybody else.
I think specifically his physical comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
There's so much of the film that relies on that, like his silly walking, you know, when
he's
Michael
banging
Caine
his pans
is,
and
is that Michael Caine is slapping him, yeah. You know, and he's supposed to not be able or
oh,
is
he,
there
like his leg.
Stabbing his
yeah.
leg or something?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just all of the physical comedy that Steve Martin brings to this character, yeah. I can't see anybody
yeah,
else.
Just,
maybe
yeah.
like a Robin Williams, maybe. But
yeah,
Steve
I don't
can
know.
I think Steve can pull off like the debonair suave and then be silly and goofy and
yeah.
you
yeah.
know.
Just what great casting in that regard.
Did you know I had never heard of this as much of a musical fan as I am, but it was made into a musical on Broadway, I think in like the late 2000s.
I'd never heard that.
Yeah, I know. I was surprised by that.
That's interesting.
Was there any head trauma in this film?
I do have a little bit. Lawrence hits a tennis ball into Freddy's head. Always funny.
Uh-huh.
And easy for actors to do because there's very little mass to the tennis ball, so they're not going to get hurt. Baseballs, on the other hand.
Baseballs will do some serious.
And then there's presumed that there's quite a bit when they pull Lawrence into the back of the truck, the Royal Navy sailors, because they think he's been up to no good. So that's presumed head trauma.
Yes, very much so. A smoochie.
Smoochie, smoochie, smoochie. There's an almost smoochie between Freddy and Janet on the beach when he's like laying there. Supposedly he'd crawled down to try to drown himself. Then there is a smoochie when Lawrence smooches Janet at the disco. And then Janet kisses Freddy when she surprises him in the hotel.
Oh, she was cool. She got around.
Yeah, well, that I think when you're a lady con artist, that's one of the things you use, right?
You use what you've got.
Yeah.
How about a driving review?
All right, there are many vehicles in here. There's a white 86 Ferrari Mondial. It's a convertible Ferrari. That says wealth, right, because it's a Ferrari.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tell the way this being driven that this is not a person who drives. This is just a person who's showing wealth.
Uh-huh.
You had found some interesting trivia that the plate looks like it's Danish, but doesn't actually make any sense. So that was just a prop license plate,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. We were making a film a number of years ago, and we were concerned about showing someone's license plate. And one of our film friends said that it's public info. You're not really giving away info if you show a license plate, at least in the U.S. So I don't know if that's the same in Monaco.
I am curious, though, because a lot of films take effort to either make something up or to blur it. I mean, I feel
right.
like it's rare to see a license plate.
So in the state of Oregon, the license plate numbers are either three letters followed by three numbers or three numbers followed by three letters. It's just the way they do it. And I was watching a movie, a TV movie, and it was set in Oregon, and they had an Oregon plate. It was actually the background, but the letters and numbers were jumbled up. So it was obviously a fake plate.
And it was like all one, right?
Yeah.
How some states just like have seven or eight characters all together.
Yeah. So the props department mimicked the physical plate configuration, but used a made-up number. It was the equivalent of the 555 telephone
number.
So, yeah, but that was an interesting clue again, anybody who had a Ferrari, even if you were a racer, that's the worst possible place to try to drive those tiny little towns. For Monaco, they have to close down the entire town to drive fast. Why bother? At that point, right. Get a Vespa. So the inspector, who I couldn't tell if he was also a car nut artist or just a corrupt police person, he drives a blue 81 Renault 4, which clashes humorously with the white Ferrari. It's this tiny little French crappy car, right? So there is a note that they had a Boeing 727 for the TWA plane. So at that time, I'm not sure that Boeing was doing well in TWA, but okay, maybe so. There's a 74 Rolls Royce that Michael Caine shows up in later in the film. And so, of course, a Rolls Royce says wealth, right? Handmade vehicle. If you have one of those, it matches with his character. What I don't know is whether the character actually owned that, because he's living in this villa. He looks like he's doing pretty well, or if that was a prop that he bought. And there, at one point, I believe they drive, but there's a red 74 Porsche, and that's pretty sporty for rich people. So it's like at the party when they walk up, and there's a lot of high-end luxury cars. The Porsche itself is more a sports car. Don't know if you'd take that to a high-end event that's a black tie, but if so, I like it. And then last but not least, plane that she flies off in is apparently it's known. It's a Gulfstream Le Président Spatial. But it was a 25-year-old plane at the time of the filming, so not exactly new, but it's what they could afford.
That was a lot. Good job.
There was a lot of vehicles in this one.
I guess to show wealth, that definitely show don't tell.
It's a prop, I think.
Yeah, a very expensive one.
Right.
All right, so we go to the numbers.
Let's go to the numbers.
This film had a budget of $6.5 million. It gets a 7.4 out of 10 on IMDb. Critics give it, on Rotten Tomatoes, 89%, and audiences give it 84%. And it made $42 million domestically. I don't have worldwide numbers, and adjusted for today, that'd be like $109 million.
Pretty good performance.
Yeah, really good performance. I remember this being like a big hit, and especially on like then what we now call streaming services, were called cable services. Like HBO, it ran a lot, and I feel like maybe you and I owned this movie.
What year is this again?
88.
88.
Like, okay. So on VHS, maybe. Yeah, yeah. I saw it more than once. Like I said, I think it would play on like Showtime or HBO.
Yeah, I think this, this was HBO repeat play.
Yeah. Cause so it had a good, it's an Orion Pictures film, and Michael Caine was nominated for Best Performance by a Male, and Glenn Headey won the Chicago Film Critics Awards. I wonder if that's also where he was nominated. I will correct myself in our show notes, let you know what he was nominated for. So that does it for this episode of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. But first, let's pick what film we're going to watch next week. The next movie we will be watching is
All About Eve.
Oh, I love that movie. I've seen All About Eve in film school. It's been a few years, so I'm looking forward to it. I enjoyed it then, but have you ever seen this film?
I think I've only seen clips. I don't think I've seen the whole thing.
I can't wait to see what you think.
All right. Like, I'm looking forward to it.
I enjoyed it. So I think you will, but especially you love those old timey, because then I get to listen to you speak like, oh, you should do your last tagline in your, can you do it?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay, ready?
I can do that. Yeah.
All right. Have a good weekend, everybody. And don't forget,
Dodgers never stop, and neither do the movies.
Very good.
Thanks for listening to Dodge Movie Podcast with Christy and Mike Dodge of Dodge Media Productions. To find out more about this podcast and what we do, go to dodgemediaproductions.com. Subscribe, share, leave a comment, and tell us what we should watch next. Dodges never stop, and neither do the movies.